This is Frank Hymans interviewing Russell Taylor on the 5th of August 2005 for the Department of Housing's Millers Point Oral History Project. This interview is being conducted at Cremorne, New South Wales. This is tape number MPFH12, side A. And while we're on the subject of acknowledgements, I'd like to make an acknowledgement to the traditional owners of this land, which would be the Cammeraygal people, because we're in Cremorne. Russell, firstly, could you tell me your full name?
Russell Charles Taylor.
All right. And tell me where and when you were born.
Born on the 12th of March 1948 in Sydney, at Paddington Women's Hospital. And at that time, at my birth, my mum and dad were both living at Millers Point, in Trinity Avenue, Millers Point.
Right.
Number 14.
14 Trinity Avenue. Right, okay. So you went home after the hospital to live there?
Yep.
You grew up in Trinity Avenue?
Yes, my brother and I had an elder brother, James, who's now passed away, but he was 3 years older than me. Just a little bit of background, Frank. My mum and dad came to live at Millers Point as a result of my grandmother, my father's mother, moving from Redfern to Millers Point, being, you know, given access to public housing. At that time, the landlord was the Maritime Service Board, but she was able to get a house at 41 Kent Street, Millers Point, some years prior to my birth. And then, of course, my mother and father got married at a young age. They moved into Kent Street. And then when my brother was born, they moved from Kent Street around to Trinity Avenue,
which is where
we had our own family home there. So out of my grandmother's house in Kent Street, around to their own home in Trinity Avenue.
Right. Now, how would you describe your mother and father? Can you tell me a bit about them?
Well, my dad was an Aboriginal fellow raised at La Perouse. Although his tribal affiliations, his ancestral country was up in the New England part of New South Wales. He was a Kamilaroi man, very proud Kamilaroi man. My grandmother came from a place called Karuna, Aboriginal Reserve, up near Corindai. And my grandmother moved down to Sydney as a very young girl, in her mid-teens. And she actually gave birth to my father, and he was raised at La Perouse. So in terms of my mum and dad, they were both working-class people, worked very hard all their life. My dad at various times... he was a tradesman. He was a painter and interior decorator, but he was one of those fellows that could do anything to do with building, carpentry, whatever. But essentially, and at various times, he worked on the waterfront as well as worked for himself as a subcontractor, trying to get work, you know, all over the place, painting houses, etc., etc. Later in life, my dad became a watchman on the waterfront, and for the last 10 years of his working life, he worked as a watchman on the waterfront, and he eventually retired from the waterfront as a watchman. I was very lucky in terms of, whilst we weren't very affluent, but, we didn't go without. Mum and Dad always made sure we had enough to eat. My dad, was an interesting person. He was a professional fighter in his youth, until he was about 27, 28, and he retired. Interestingly enough, Frank, my dad wasn't a drinker until his late 20s when he retired from boxing, but he made up for it. And I can say to you that during parts of his life, his early life, certainly, you know, he had problems with a drink, but we managed to overcome that, and, it doesn't detract from my relationships with him and, our love of my mum and dad and all that, but it certainly caused a few problems during his lifetime and, my relationship with my mum and dad. My mum came from a very large family. They also were Redfern people. Married my dad at a very, very young age. I think they were boyfriend and girlfriend in their early teens. And they married, I think, when my mother was 16 and my dad was 18.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty young.
And I was born, my brother was born, and I was born. I think my mum was 19 or 20 when I was born. So they were young, you know, married couple, young parents, struggled most of their working life, but, you know, did their best to make sure that my brother and I, you know, didn't go without too much, and were very, I think, supportive parents. Or don't think, I know they were. But I have to say also that I think they really enjoyed living in Millers Point. It was an interesting place to live, I think, and I've said this in other discussions, but you know, one of the things that I guess that most people on Millers Point at that time, and I'm talking, you know, I was born in 48 and I was raised in the 50s and 60s at Millers Point, left probably, you know, to make my own life in the late 60s. When I was about 17 or 18, I left home and sort of, although I didn't live on Millers Point until quite later, but I always considered, you know, there was that strong sense of home, a strong sense of, you know, that's my, it's where I belong. Yeah, so, I mean, in terms of, you know, some of the issues in terms of my family, certainly both my dad and my grandmother were, I think, well regarded by the community. And my grandmother, who lived in Kent Street, was universally known as Auntie Mary. Everybody that knew her, whether they were old, young or whatever, called her and referred to her as Auntie Mary. And, you know, were aware of her Aboriginality and my dad and my family's Aboriginality. And I think I've said this before, Frank, that whilst that was an issue, there were many other issues as well that had to do with religion, politics, not just the sort of racial issues that we had to deal with.
Were there any racial issues? I mean, as an Aboriginal, did you find...
Yes, there were. I mean, you know, very much... I mean, you know, you're talking a community that was very much, you know, Eurocentric, or not even Euro, British, really, British Celtic background. Irish, Scots and Pommies were, you know, the main heritage in terms of Millers Point. Because Millers Point, as you know, most of the housing there when I was a baby and then growing up, most of the housing there was public housing. It was created to provide low, affordable accommodation for the waterfront workforce. And those workforce consisted of people that worked as wharfies, stevedores on the waterfront, you know, worked on the tugs, merchant seamen, and all the sort of auxiliary services that go to having, you know, a competitive maritime industry. So most of the people that lived and worked on, or lived in Millers Point, somehow or other were associated with the maritime industries. And of course, most of those people, as I say, came from a sort of a Celtic, you know, British background rather than European or any other. And certainly, you know, there were racial issues there where it's a question, I guess, of difference, a question of stereotypical type responses, etc. Whilst my Aboriginality and my family's Aboriginality were never an issue that we went to war on, it was always something that was, you know, raised, particularly in the heat of battle, if you're an argument with somebody or whatever, you could always expect some insult to do with our, you know, with our being blackfellas, etc. But that's, you know, not to say that there weren't many other types of insults that had to do with a whole range of other things. So, yes, there were racial issues there, Frank, particularly, you know, in the 50s and 60s where the migration generally was increasing. And a good thing too, where, you know, no doubt the skill shortages and all the rest of it demanded that we improve our immigration inflows. I have to say that I probably wasn't conscious of it as a young man, as a young boy, but probably later in life I appreciated, the impact, although it wasn't great, I don't think, to Millers Point particularly. But over time, there's no doubt that the waterfront, you've only got to look at the makeup of some of the waterfront, you know, the gangs, the wharfie gangs, etc., where previously they'd be all, you know, Celtic, you know, white Australians, and over time they took on a different composition, including, you know, Italians and Greeks, Maltese and so on, taking the European sort of influences, and of course more recently, you know, Asian. So that was not, I mean, although that was starting to happen when I was a boy, not sure there was that conscious of it, there was certainly the black-white issues, no doubt about it.
Right. Well, as there are many other political issues too, we'll get onto that later. Now, do you or your family associate yourselves with any Aboriginal tribal groups?
Yeah, my dad, myself, and my brother and my grandmother, and not so much my mum, but we identify as Kamilaroi people. And those people, as I say, come from the New England part of New South Wales, around Tamworth, Moree, around that part of the country. As I say, my dad, you know, even though he was, you know, he died in the wool miller's point person, but he always talked about back home as being, you know, the lands that are associated with the, you know, the tribal lands of the Kamilaroi mob. My grandmother had some, I wouldn't say she didn't have the language, but she certainly knew many Kamilaroi words and used them from time to time, though she didn't speak fluently, because I think during her life, because she hadn't used the language, she'd lost it. But there were many words that from time, particularly swear words from time to time, that she would use. And I would identify, and I knew what they were, but maybe nobody else did.
I gave you a special...
My brother position. And I, and my father, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of an in-joke in terms of some of the language that he used. But I guess we're all victims of our time too, Frank, where, you know, the policy of the day in those days was integration, no question about that, and assimilation. And the attitude of the mainstream wider community was that if you didn't assimilate, well, there was something wrong with you. And so we were sort of part of that, where I know my dad, whilst I think he was very proud of his, you know, his tribal affiliations, and but there's no doubt that in order to get work, in order to continue to get work, you know, we assimilated in most characteristics and most aspects of our life. And that's, you know, I guess from my dad's point of view particularly, something that was necessary in order to make sure that, you know, we could get work and therefore feed the family and pay the rent and all the rest of it.
Now, you remember the referendum of 1967?
Yeah, I know, it's funny, you know, Frank. I was 18 at the time, and I do remember, you know, but I have to say there probably wasn't another 10 or 20 years before the significance of it dawned. And the reason is that nothing much changed. You know, I know it was a landmark decision and a great, you know, in terms of the referendum, you know, the one that's been carried with the most majority and all that. So it was historic, and, you know, we felt at the time it would it would address and redress things that needed to be addressed. And, you know, it's debatable as to whether that has been the case, but that's not the purpose of this interview. But, yes, I do remember it, but it didn't... The significance of it didn't hit me until much later in life.
Did it make any difference to your family?
No, none whatsoever. In that context, I mean, it was about... you know, people misguidedly say, oh, it's when, you know, blackfellas got the vote. Well, quite frankly, it was nothing to do with it.
No.
And it was about, the, you know, a sharing or shifting of powers between state and Commonwealth governments. So I have to say that in terms of the Taylor family at Trinity Avenue, it really had no impact. But not to say it wasn't a significant development.
Mm.
As I say, that I think that, without dwelling on it, I think the significance really didn't hit me until later in life.
Right, sure. Now, some Aboriginal families actually fought in the Second World War. Did your family have any members?
Yes, my Uncle Jim, Jim Quinn, who I've mentioned to you, the family that lived at Millers Point. They're our cousins, and their family lived in Millers Point. They moved out about the time, or when I was a baby, you know, young, 3 or 4 year old. I don't remember them living in Millers Point, although I was aware that they did, and they moved to Ryde. My uncle actually got a soldier settlement, you know, and a war service loan to get the house. And he was a blackfella from Narromine, I think my Uncle Jim came from. So, and my dad, of course, was, although he didn't see any action, but he was in the Air Force during the war. And we are aware of many, many, you know, extended family members, not so much from Sydney, but certainly from, you know, up Tamworth Way and all that were in the armed forces. It's an interesting issue, Frank, that, you know, even during times when we, you know, weren't able to vote and weren't really counted in the census as citizens, etc., but there's certainly plenty of them in the army and plenty of them fighting for Australia.
So it's just quite
and many of them, of course, suffered the indignity of coming back and not being able to join the local RSL club because they're a blackfella. And I know many instances of that where they're absolutely, you know, excluded, and not only excluded, but evicted from the club premises. Really? And yet those same blokes fought alongside their Well, so it was one of the tragedies, I guess, one of the injustices that Aboriginal people suffered as a consequence of, you know, fighting for their country.
Yeah, that's terrible. Now, do you know anything about the Aboriginal occupation of Millers Point before the white man came? I know.
Well, in terms of the sort of cultural history of Sydney, Frank, I don't want to make claim to having any first-hand, involvement or appreciation of the Aboriginal history. I think that even by the time, or certainly by the time that I was a young fella and growing up there, most of the physical signs of Aboriginal occupation had gone, or if they were still there, they'd certainly been built upon or covered up in some way. For instance, you know, rock art, middens, etc., normal signs of occupation. There weren't any of those that I'm aware of. And, of course, the whole waterfront had been done over many, many times, including some major, you know, engineering development of some consequence in the early 1900s. But I'm aware that certainly there's no doubt that it would have been, and Millers Point particularly, given its proximity to the harbour and the food and all the rest of it that, that has to do with saltwater people. It would have been a great sort of food basin, I guess, and a sheltered one at that, whereas to the east of the harbour, you know, it's not so sheltered, whereas places around Dawes Point, Walsh Bay, Darling Harbour is quite sheltered compared to some other parts. So it would have certainly been utilised to the maximum by Aboriginal groups as a food source, as a source of ceremony, as a camping area, no question about that. The dilemma, I guess, is from an Aboriginal history, probably the rocks and surrounds, Millers Point and surrounds is, I apologise for using the term in the same context, Frank, because they are different places. I think you and I have spoken about this. But Millers Point and the rocks area was probably the first or one of the first areas affected by European settlement. And so it would have been one of the first areas where blackfellas would have been dispossessed and excluded. Because as you can appreciate, if it's a good source of food to blackfellas, it's also a good source of food to whitefellas. And, you know, not necessarily in a sharing mode. Sydney, as you know, was decimated by disease as well as by dispossession, warfare, discrimination, you name it. To the point where, you know, the Aboriginal population was, you know, within less than 50 years was almost non-existent. Although there were pockets, you know, like La Perouse and others where Aboriginal people had been sort of shifted to as a means of getting them out of sight and out of the way. But generally speaking, so at Millers Point would have been a very, very, you know, one of the first battlegrounds where that happened. And then, of course, you know, Millers Point was densely populated in terms of, you know, the residential development and quasi-government, public sector development that taking place, as well as, of course, being a very, very important port area, as was the whole harbour, but particularly around Darling Harbour, you know, Dawes Point, Walsh Bay, etc., really important port area. Yeah. And very busy.
Which marked its character. Really.
Absolutely.
That's where its character comes
that's
from.
That's right, and, you know, that's where you get the development of densely populated area, mix it with, you know, the outcomes of sort of regular visitations from sailors and seamen from all over the world. The need to, you know, to have, if you like, R&R facilities for those sort of people, including, you know, boarding houses, brothels, you know, pubs, all of the things that seamen and others, you know, enjoy.
Frequency.
And, of course, as you probably know, the rocks and Millers Point at different times had, you know, almost a pub on every corner. Not to sure how many, but they had certainly had a lot of them.
Sure.
And they were all, you know, very busy, from what I understand. I must say that when I was a young fella, and I mean, you know, a baby between probably 5 and 15, so growing up in that period, certainly, Frank, I think we've talked about this earlier, that I can vividly remember that time that all of the pubs were busy. They were all full most of the time. There were scenes of all sorts of interesting activity, including violence, and violence not only just between locals, who maybe have had too much to drink from time to time, but also between the visiting seamen, particularly Pommies, British seamen, and the locals who always wanted to try and work out who was the strongest and who was the best drinkers and who was the best fighters. And we regularly, as kids, you know, witnessed that. It was part of our entertainment. You'd regularly, if you sat outside one of the busier pubs of a Friday or a Saturday night, particularly Saturday night, you could be assured that you'd see a few interesting fights and all that sort of thing. There was always entertainment going on.
I believe that you've even seen a murder outside a pub, have you?
Well, I'll be careful here. I mean, I didn't see murder, but I know that there was more than, you know, quite a few. I recall, I think I mentioned to you, Frank, where a very good friend of my father's was shot in one of the hotels. I think that was a domestic dispute, but nevertheless, it ended up in the death of a young man who was shot dead. There have been various other incidents. I know a fellow was shot outside another hotel. It was supposed to be an assassination. I've heard of various near-death bashings and very serious injuries as a result of bashings, whatever. So, you know, and I've lost a few friends, but that's through, you know, drug abuse and all that sort of stuff. Sadly, that's part of, I guess, like everywhere now, but Miller's Point's certainly gone through that, where they've at different times and probably still going on, where drugs are a real problem there.
Right. But Miller's Point, I get the feeling, isn't really such a violent place. So people
I think it's gentrified. I don't doubt that, and that's why I was a bit cautious about. I don't want to give it a bad name, but certainly in my time, it was tough. It was a tough neighbourhood, and you know there are areas like, you know, different Surry Hills, Woolloomooloo, Piermont, you know, Glebe, Miller's Point, where you knew that there were, I wouldn't say gangs, but there were alliances of people that lived in those areas that were prone to violence, no question about that. Usually a lot of petty crime and some not-so-petty crime going on. But if you went even for a visit in some of those areas, you could expect some sort of confrontation, and the same if you came to Miller's Point. I mean, going into the early days of Miller's Point, as you know, the Rocks Push was infamous, where, you know, not just petty crimes, but very serious crimes, including murder, were a feature of what used to go on every weekend almost. So I wouldn't say that it was as bad as that in my time, but I have to say, Frank, that there were some very, very, very colourful characters in my time. You know, what we would now, some people are called, you know, colourful racing identities, but, you know, whichever way you look at it, they were criminals, and they were career criminals, serious criminals. You know, some of those people were looked up to in the community. They were considered to be achievers. One of the elements of Miller's Point when I was a young fellow was that there was always this demarcation line between, you know, the community and the police. It wasn't a friendly relationship.
Some of those colourful characters might not be around anymore. But can you name any of them?
Oh, I've got to be careful here, but I maybe prefer not to. I mean, some of them are still around, Frank, but maybe I better not, because once you start naming one or two. But all I can say is that they were, there's no doubt, you know, career criminals, in whether it be in, you know, waterfront related pilfering and in a serious way, or, you know, SB bookmaking or whatever.
I believe you have a little experience yourself at SB Bookies. Tell me about that.
I've got to be careful. As a young fellow, I always thought SB bookmaking was the way to get very rich very quickly. So myself and a couple of friends, we had some very unsuccessful attempts at setting up SB bookmaking. And without saying too much, but it sort of came to an end when I got arrested at one stage and went to court, and I thought, oh, that's it, I won't do that again.
Which hotel was it?
Well, I was actually arrested at the Harbourview Hotel. In what is now, when I look back, you know, it was quite obvious that the fellow was a copper, but I didn't, in those days, have the bloody brains to, you know, just to leave. I thought I was pretty smart. But I must say, Frank, I know we keep going off in red, but SB bookmaking, from the community point of view, was considered to be a legitimate occupation. And, you know, a bit of a, apart from a protest against authority, but it was a legitimate occupation. Everybody on Miller's Point had an interest in the races, whether they be the thoroughbreds or the greyhounds or the trots. In fact, there were many. There were quite a few people that trained greyhounds and lived at Millersport. So there was this ongoing interest in gambling, in the sport of kings, and, you know, all these. And, of course, in every pub, and as I said, there was quite a few pubs in Millersport, but in every pub there was an SP bookmaker. And there were some that were based in some of the houses. That, for instance, just to give you a bit of an idea, you know, there was one in Merriman Street, there was one in Wimmer Street, there was one in Cumberland Street, there was one in Kent Street. There was an SP bookmaker, you know, wherever you, there was, you know, you had a choice. And I can well remember taking my grandmother's bets around with a little note, and there'd be a 20-cent piece wrapped up in the note, and you'd have all her property bets written out, and I'd take them to the SP bookmaker, and then if she had any, and, you know, deliver those, and then I'd go back home, and if she had any results, I'd have to go back and collect it for her. That was a done thing, mate. It was, you know, it's gone now, of course. The TAB has put pay to that, you know, that's made it legal to bet off course, but it was all about that, and, you know, your champions such as, you know, Tullock and Farlap and all that sort of thing. I mean, people from Millers Point, they were their greatest supporters. They love that industry. And I suggest they still do. They probably can bet legally now, though, on the TAB. But it was one. It was a feature, I think, of... Well, I think it's a feature of general, of sort of working-class people, that they have these, you know, love of those sort of sport. It's an opportunity also, of course, to win some money. There's always what's the word, that reward, if you like, or that you might strike it rich. Same with lotteries. You know, I well remember my grandmother and my mum buying lottery tickets all the time, and still do.
Now, I believe the pubs were more than just hotels. They were more like support systems. What kind of things did they all have? Yeah.
Well, most of the pubs had their own, and I'm talking about now, you know, pubs like the Hero Waterloo, the Palisade, Captain Cook, the Harbour View, all at different times had their regulars. And all at different times had their own either social clubs or, you know, activities that would regularly be involved, you know, might involve some sort of social get-togethers, might be a dance, might be, you know, an outing, might be a ferry cruise or whatever. And they were very solidly supported by, you know, the local Millers Point and people from the Rocks as well, where you had your regulars and you were sort of identified by which pub you actually were associated with. I mean, my dad, you know, we lived across the road from the Hero Waterloo, so, you know, he was well-known in that place, but also, you know, the Harbour View. So it changed over time, where you'd switch allegiances for whatever reason, they'd get a new publican, and all of a sudden, you know, there'd be this changing of the guard as to, in terms of which local you supported. But they were very, and they still continue to do so. Even when I, later in life, Frank, I had a business on Millers Point for a couple of years, and I tried to reinvigorate the Millers Point football team. And the basis for that was both the Captain Cook Hotel and the Palisade Hotel, who strongly supported the football sides. And so they were, even in terms of that sporting activity, they were the hub of, you know, that's where you went to talk, that's where you went to have a drink, that's where you went to have your meetings. If you had some sort of, you know, committee, that's where you went to meet. That's where you went after the game, you'd go back to the pub and have some sort of post-mortem as to why you got beat and all that sort of stuff. So, and that, I'm sure that that's been the case at Millers Point almost from day one, from the first time the pubs first opened, that it's provided some sort of social basis and linkage to the community. And, of course, not everybody, I don't want to give the wrong impression, not everybody in Millers Point are drinkers. And I know many of my friends and their parents where, the dad might enjoy a drink, but of course the mother didn't. So it's not just the fact that you get a drink there; it's the fact that it was a physical basis for people to come together and meet and either have a sing song or whatever it might be. And that's a very important role. I think probably one or two of the pubs still provide that for a smaller number of people now.
I'll just make an announcement. That's the end of tape number MPFH 12, side A. This is the start of tape number MPFH 12, side B. Were the ladies allowed to drink in the main lounge, or was there a special...
When I was a young fellow, I well remember most pubs had ladies' lounges. And it wasn't done, Frank, to see women in the public bar. That was a men's only domain. And anybody, if there was a woman in there, they were usually considered to be, you know, not a very nice woman, and somehow or other lacking in ethics or standards or whatever. You really, rarely. And I think, you know, like, for instance, I can remember my mum, who, you know, was a big drinker, but she enjoyed a drink, and but she'd, you know, go to the ladies' parlour, and, you know, Dad would bring out a, you know, a small shandy or whatever, and us kids would sit down. Now, it depends which pub you're talking. Not every, most pubs, though, had their ladies' lounges. And that was, I think, the, you know, a segregation that sort of continued right up till probably the 70s. Although, you know, it might even be before that, but certainly I can remember quite vividly. I don't remember, Frank, I think, up till the 60s, they had the 6 o'clock closing. And I only vaguely remember this. I don't say I have some vivid memories, but the relaxation of those trading laws where pubs were able to open until 10 o'clock was a dramatic change across the nation, probably, or certainly across the city, but I think it had a major impact in Millers Point.
What sort of impact?
Well, I think that it wasn't necessarily a positive one, I think, because what used to happen there is the men who were mainly, you know, waterside workers finish work and then go to the pub and they know they could drink till six. And, you know, they had what they used to call the 6 o'clock swill, which would mean you can drink as much as you like, but 6 o'clock, you have to stop. But then they go and have tea and sit down with their families, have dinner, have tea and, you know, have some family quality time. And I think, and I'm only assuming this to a great degree, Frank, but I suggest that once that stopped and they didn't have to go home at 6 o'clock, it meant that, you know, there wasn't as much family harmony and family time spent together as there should have been for many of the family. Not for all of them, but for quite a few. Because all of a sudden, you know, they stay till 10 o'clock. Now, you know, any impact on that, I really don't know. I'll be talking from my hat, but I suspect that it was a major change.
Right, sure. Now, tell me a little bit about your schooling at Millers Point.
Well, you know, I must say my schooling memories are very, very fond. But having said that, I always regret the fact that I left schooling in Millers Point too early. By that I mean I went to kindergarten in Lance Kindergarten in High Street, like many of my mates, friends. Then I went to Fort Street Primary School. But in fourth class, I was asked to go to a bloody opportunity class at Summerhill. So I was ripped out of my place that I knew with all my mates, friends, you know, girls and boys. And then, you know, as a young kid, fifth class, what was that, 9 or 10? 10 and 11, whatever it was. And then, you know, I had to travel, you know, from Millers Point to Summerhill every day for 2 years to go to school. And I didn't mind that to some extent, but I always regretted the fact that I wasn't with my mates. And, you know, to some extent, I mean, I don't think I suffered greatly from it, but I did regret that I didn't share those last couple of years in primary school with my mates, you know, people that I'd grown up with and people who I'm still friends with. And then, Frank, I from Summerhill in fifth and sixth class, I went to Fort Street Boys High, and I was very pleased about that. Although, funnily enough, I actually applied to go to Cleveland Street, where my father and my brother had both gone to school, and where many of my friends, you know, who were in the same year, although back at Millers Point, were going to Cleveland Street from Millers Point, most of them, actually.
Really?
They either went to two schools. Millers, from Fort Street Primary, it seems, I may have this wrong, but it seems to me they either went to Cleveland Street, I'm talking about the boys now, or they went to Rose Hill in Balmain. And most of them went to Cleveland Street, and that's where I wanted to go, for a whole range of reasons, because I was going to be reunited with my mates.
Right.
But it never happened, because I went to Fort Street. And I don't regret that, because I made plenty of good friends, and I enjoyed my schooling.
You remember
Fort Street Primary, in those days, I think, was a very, very good school. I don't know how many kids went there, but there was a lot. Every class was full. I think it was, they had some very good teachers there. Mind you, I think we were a pretty difficult bunch, generally. They had, you know, regular canings at that school. I remember dramatically vividly getting the cane on a number of occasions. And I remember many, many, many of my mates getting the cane, mostly boys. I never ever saw a girl getting cane. I don't know what the punishment for the girls were, but it certainly wasn't caning or detention. And we had some like every school, you know, we had our tyrants as teachers and we had some good teachers. But I really enjoyed it, mate. We'd do things, most things, schools organised, such as they had plays and cantatas, sports days, swimming carnivals, all the things that you do, you know, in my view of the healthy range of activities. I think the academic standard was pretty good. In fact, I know it was. The reason I know that is because I was, you know, a reasonable student, but I know that particularly one or two of the girls were brilliant students, and they went on in life to show that. So that the academic standard was pretty good.
Now, Russ, were there any other Aboriginal families living in Millers Point while you were there?
Not that I'm aware of, Frank. The only other one, as I say, my own family, the Quinns, but they left Millers Point about the time that I started, between the time I was born and the time I started going to school. I'm not sure of the exact year. I must ask my mother, actually, to get it right. So the answer is, to my knowledge, no. But that's not to say, I mean, you know, people either may or may not have wanted to identify. I certainly don't remember any, you know, in terms of black kids running around, there was no others. As I say, my brother and myself were the only ones that I'm aware of that, you know, got, you know, insulted or whatever from time to time. On that issue, of course, there's always kids fighters, you know. So the answer is no, Frank, but that's not to say there was, it's just that I certainly wasn't aware of them.
Now, how high did you go in high school? What level did you...
I finished the Leaving Certificate. I, you know, matriculated, but I, at that stage, I'd had enough of asking my mum and dad for money every time I needed some money. So I went and I worked for a bank. I worked for a bank for 20 years. And then in the 80s, I gave that away. And funnily enough, I bought a business at the Rocks at Millers Point. I bought a shop and I was there for about nearly 4 years. And then I got into the public sector of Aboriginal Affairs and I've been involved in that ever since, both at the Commonwealth and state level.
Right, we'll get into more detail of those particular occupations. Talking a little bit about religion, was your family religious?
No, my dad. I'm sorry I'm laughing, but my dad, during different times, you know, sort of embraced, well, he didn't embrace religion, but there were signs at times where I think he wanted to. But the answer, I think, Frank's no, that we weren't a particular religious family. My brother and I think, were given our own brain on that as to whether we went to church. We actually, you know, identified as members of the Church of England rather than Catholic or any other. But I have to say, mate, that apart from attending church as a very, very young kid, we were quite unreligious in terms of our... And I think, you know, my dad sort of struggled with that because... Well, for a whole lot of reasons, including, you know, his own upbringing, where he had a pretty hard upbringing, and I think he needed to be convinced that there was some benefit in being religious, given he had a hard time, and he suffered a lot of racial abuse in his life. So you know, I think he left my brother and myself make up our own minds, and I might add, I've done the same thing to my own children. My wife's Catholic, and I'm happy for them to be raised as Catholic. And my wife, actually, Frank, funnily enough, is she's not a, you know, a native of Millers Point, but we met, you know, because of her family owning a business in Millers Point. And she's still a member of the committee of St. Bridget's Church, very active churchgoer. Goes to Mass every week. She's on the community, the church committee, and you know, all that sort of stuff. So we still retain that, and my three children went to St. Bridget's. As I say, were raised as Catholics. I went to Catholic education, unlike me, where we had a public school education. I had a public school education. So we still retain that interest. And whenever, you know, something's happening around, particularly around St. Bridget's, you know, we try and... Well, I quite often go to Mass with Judy, but I don't do much. I just sit there and go with her and sit down and shut up. So no, mate, we weren't.
No.
I must say, the church... my dad, who for a number of years had a very close relationship with the bloke by the name of Bingham, who was the, you know, the minister for the Garrison Church, and my dad and he got on very well. And I think he was trying to convert my dad and get him to come to school, come to church, but my dad never ever, although he enjoyed the bloke's company and they got on very well, I don't think he ever succumbed to his invitations. And my dad, funnily enough, Frank, actually painted the rectory on a number of occasions.
He painted it?
Painted, you know, as a whenever it needed. He got the job a couple of times to actually paint, which is a magnificent house, you know, it's a lovely house on the corner there, corner of Trinity Avenue and Lower Fortsford.
Your father was a painter for the MSB, was he?
Yeah, he worked for it for a little while, but he's mainly a contractor for his own right. I must say he was a very good painter. Very good, very... Everybody that, wherever he did he work, was, you know, were always commenting the fact how good he was. He was very good. Because he had his trade and all that, as I said.
Right. Now, it's been said that the rocks, the old history of the rocks, that in those early days of the colony, that there were some Aboriginal white marriages, unacceptable society, that used to sort of happen there. Can you share any light on that?
I don't know any particular instance, Frank, but I have no doubt that that would be the case. You know, where it's, and I'm aware of many examples, you know, across the country, but there's no doubt that in those days, it was an uncommon, particularly when you look at the working class, you know, I'm aware that certainly in the first 100 or so years of Australia, we still haven't dropped the class, prejudices, etc. But in terms of, you know, the working class and the, if you like to use the term, lower classes, there's no doubt, as in elsewhere in Australia, where unmarried men who don't readily have a pool of other partners, form relationships with Aboriginal women. And so I've got no doubt that that may or may not have been the case. So I'm sure it would have been the case at Millers Point. It's funny, Frank, that, or not funny, but it's a phenomenon that in terms of the disposition that happened, you know, over time between white and black Australia, there's no doubt that the first people that were adversely affected by that were the men. So they'll be the first to suffer the consequences. Mm. And, you know, for obvious reasons, probably, that, you know, they're the hunters and the fighters, etc. So as a result, you know, generally speaking, in a society that's affected by that sort of interaction, you know, there is a, you know, quite a difference in terms of the numbers of men and the numbers of women. But in terms of, you know, how cultures interact on the sort of edges of society, there's no doubt that you know, those relationships would have been formed. The more difficult one and most unusual is the other way around, where you have white women taking up relationship with black men, although I'm aware of quite a few of those, not so much at Millers Point, but certainly in Sydney. But I have no doubt, mate, I have to be honest, you know, Aboriginal women are pretty attractive women, you know. As I say, although I won't rave on, I'm not surprised that would be the case, although I don't know of any particular examples, not my time, but certainly in Millers, I'm not aware of any particular examples.
Now, there's an interesting kind of historical background to, say, Hickson Road, that you probably know about, you've spoken to me
a little
about,
bit, yeah.
And the plague, these are sort of major events that happened, you know, in the history of Millers Point. Do you know anything about the influence of the plague or what
only
happened?
You know, just for reading history is not something that I can say, and of course, you know, I'd have to probably be another 100 years old, Frank, but there's no doubt there was two things that occurred about the same time. One, in the beginning of the 20th century, that's around about 1900, you know, Sydney all of a sudden, you know, had this bubonic plague on its hands. And around about the same time, I wouldn't say right, within the same decade or two, there was a need to really make the waterfront much more effective, much more efficient. So two things happened that I'm not sure which one facilitated the other, but there was an awful lot of housing destroyed as a result of trying to get rid of the plague. You know, the way that I understand they either did it was to quarantine the houses and then either whitewash them completely or just knock them over and burn them. And so that was the start. And, of course, Millers Point was the first place where the plague was first recorded. Although I understand, Frank, I don't know, you'd have to check the history books, but whilst it was the first case recorded, the person didn't die, funnily enough, isn't it? But it was the first case recorded, and there were other deaths, right? And in fact, Miller's point wasn't, from what I've read, whilst there might have been one or two deaths, there wasn't a lot of deaths. There were deaths elsewhere in the city, but not at Miller's Point. But nevertheless, the waterfront was deemed to be the place where the vapours and whatever created, or whatever they thought created bubonic plague was, they didn't realise it was caused, you know, by the fleas, blah, blah, blah. So, and about that time also, ship owners realised that in terms of, you know, global trends, et cetera, there was still an awful lot of money to be made in shipping. And Australia, you know, whether it's exports or imports, is ripe for that. We're an island. And they realised that they needed to modernise the waterfront. And there was a major world-class, actually, re-engineering of the Millers Point area, particularly Walsh Bay, Darling Harbour, around the area, which, you know, you see it now in Hickson Road and the upper levels of the wharves and the bridges to give greater access. Whereas previously, you know, it was pretty archaic, even to the point where, you know, in the wrong weather, you know, you couldn't even get a wagon or whatever in to unload. So that occurred around about within the same, I say 10 or 20 years, I mean, it sounds a long time, but and I'm not sure which facilitated the other, but it was a dramatic re-engineering and reshaping of Millers Point in the Rocks area. Well, not so much the Rocks, but certainly the Walsh Bay, Darling Harbour side of things, where, you know, all of a sudden it's sealed roads and better access and more modern waterfront facilities, all of that sort of thing, which of course put a lot of money in. And the ship owners, I think, were very clever in that they got the public purse to pay for that, even though they were the main beneficiaries of that efficiencies. The plague, of course, eventually they found out what was causing it. And, you know, they had the rat catches and all the rest of it. But it was interesting in that, you know, it was, I guess, also an opportunity for the city council people to say, well, here's an opportunity to clean up the rocks, which is no doubt, by all accounts, was absolutely, you know, to use a rough term, a shitbox. Mm. In terms of, you know, the quality of housing, the squalor, the poverty, the things that were happening there, substance abuse, drink abuse, disease, including, you know, STDs, blah, blah, blah. Now, by all accounts, it was a pretty awful place.
When you were growing up, Russell, would you have considered you and your family to be sort of poor?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, look, my mum and dad maybe have a different view here, but I think I've said this before, Frank, and I think that's one of the things that everybody shared that lived in Millers Point, was that we're all pretty, well, we shared poverty or elements of it. I think nobody had much money that I can recall. I can't remember anybody being particularly wealthy, although there was elements of that, and everybody, you know, maybe, because I was young and growing up, I mean, for instance, all of a sudden, you know, you see someone with a new car or someone with, you know, television when it first started in 56, or one of my neighbours was one of the first person to get a television. And I can recall, and all of a sudden there were 40 kids sitting in his bloody lounge room watching this TV. And one or two of the pubs got television. But coming back, and, you know, that was a great thing. I remember very well, I used to go around to my grandmother's place in Kent Street, and we'd stand outside the Captain Cook Hotel, and they used to have swinging doors. And every now and then someone would walk in or out, and you would be able to see the TV. And that was a great thing. We weren't allowed to stand in the door, and we certainly weren't allowed to stand inside the door in the pub, because the publican kicks up the bum and tells us to go. But we would stand on the footpath waiting for someone, and every now and then one of the kids would walk over and swing the door so you could see the TV. but coming back to your question, Frank, there's no doubt that the nature of the waterfront and the structure of the wages, and even though, you know, my dad was a tradesman, but, you know, he managed to get X amount of dollars away. I might have, my mother worked all her life. So, you know, we were living probably from hand to mouth most weeks. I don't recall my mother or my father ever giving me evidence that we had a lot of savings. I don't remember if we did. I'm not aware of it. Not until later in life, anyway. And I think most families were the same. I think I've shared this with you before, but we managed to pay all the bills. I don't remember us being behind in our rent, and I well remember the rent man coming to collect the rent. As I do remember, you know, the bread carter when I was a little fella, and the ice man and the coal man coming. You know, those days, that was common. One of the things so I think we did share our poverty, and there was, you know, a bit of variation within the community. There'd be probably some people who were better off. But if they were, they weren't terribly well off. They were just better off, maybe because they were more frugal or, you know, maybe non-drinkers, non-gamblers, who knows, I don't know. But most people didn't have much money, I have to say, Frank, and as kids, whatever money we had, you know, you had to scrounge it, or you'd, I think I've suggested to you before, you know, we'd try and borrow some things that weren't lost from time to time. We'd try and, you know, I can vividly remember pitching drinks off the drink trucks, or, you know, whatever delivery trucks would come, we would try and pinch something. And it was all, we knew, most of the kids knew when, which trucks were due on which days. And in the school holidays, we'd be, you know, strategically placed so that when the driver went in to get the order, we'd borrow one or two drinks off the back of his truck. We'd go down the wharf, we'd have, you know, string bags, and you'd put the drinks in the string bag and lower them down the water so that at least they'd be cool, not hot, those sort of things. But, you know, not a very affluent society as a whole. Funnily enough, you know, the businesses in those days down there, Frank, seemed to do well, or do okay. And there are, you know, a couple of grocery shops, a couple of milk bars, fish and chip shop, a couple of greengrocers, Joe Leonard, who I vividly remember, a great friend of my mum and dad, Kathy Leonard, who's on that list, her dad ran one of the greengrocer shops. And, you know, I can remember vividly going round with my mother giving me the shopping list. I'd go around and give it to Mrs. Smith, whose shop was on the corner of Argyle Street and High Street. And I'd give her the list. She'd fill up all these bloody things I'd have to carry home, and that would go on the book. You know, there no cash changed hands, and I assume then that every month my mum would go around and settle the account. And the same, you know, I know many other families did that. So we were living sort of from week to week, and then when you got your wages, you'd go and fix the bill. Yes, and I can remember that very, you know, Mrs. Smith would say to you, "Who, you know, does that go in the book, Russ?" And say, "Yes, please." And she'd write in the book, and it was a done thing, you know. And I think, you know, many, many families use that facility. So it just indicates to me that I think most of us were in the same boat. We didn't have a lot of money, mate.
But like the sort of communal credit system.
Yeah.
Now, exactly. Russ, what were some of the names that the locals gave to specific parts of Millers Point? I believe there were some really interesting names.
Oh, well, you know, the places. In terms of the waterfront, I mean, they're probably more than this, but different parts of the waterfront were known by, and I have to give me thinking cap on now, but places around Walsh Bay, there was one place called the Floods, which I think was, goes back, I think, Frank, to Floods being the original ship owner or wharf owner years ago, and it retained that name, even though, in fact, the water police later on took up occupancy, and I think there's a bloody modern hotel there now.
Isn't that where the Park Hyatt now
Yeah,
is?
Park Hyatt's there. And that was known, I think, as the Floods. There was another place come around a bit further about, I think it was between 1 and 4 Walsh Bay, which was known as the Chains, and it was a good fishing spot. Just the Metal Wharf, which is probably the main meeting place in the summer for many of us kids, because we all swam there, and we were always getting chastised by our parents for swimming there regularly. And every school holiday, there wouldn't be one school holiday went past where you didn't have, at some stage, have a swim down the Metal Wharf. Not sure where it got its name, but its proper name is Town's Place. But it was known as the Met, or Metal Wharf. Geez, I don't know, I think.
What about the pickup? Where was that?
Well, the pickup was in Town's Place, which was the wharfish pickup, was the main area. You know, where the wharfies were engaged in terms of their briefs. It sort of goes, I mean, it was a better system than the old Hungry Mile system, where they were just picked up, you know, on the nod of a head, and the foreman, I understand, were, you know, the people who decided whether you worked or not for that day. Millers Point, I think I mentioned this, Frank, was there were plenty of, I'm not sure why or what the background to it, but many, many of the waterside workers that lived at Millers Point were foremen, known as pannos. It was a colloquial sort of name. And they'd often jokingly refer to Millers Point as Pannos Point, because there were a number of foremen. I remember a friend of my father, Frank Flood, and his brother Jack, they were both foremen. I have to think about it now, but there were many, many others. And they were pretty hard men, and they were, men to be reckoned with. And I'm not, they were also probably very good workers as well, but, one of the reasons that they got them job, I'm sure, is because they could exert a bit of influence, a bit of control. So, that's been part of the history of the place, forever. I mean, there's always been, the majority of the residents of Millers Point have fulfilled the role of providing, labour for whatever the shipping and maritime industries around them, but particularly wharfies and their leaders, I guess. But, and also, of course, not that I know a lot about it, Frank, but has a very interesting history in terms of the union movement in this country.
What's so interesting about it?
Well, it was a major... I mean, my dad being a sort of outsider of that industry, because he was a painter and decorator and not a particularly unionised person, although he became so later when he became a watchman. But if you were a member of the union, you simply didn't work for him. So you had to embrace union ideals and the collective bargaining, collective decision making, all of that. And quite frankly, if you did not, you were certainly put in Coventry, but there might be other things that you might have to contend with, including simply being a black man, you wouldn't work. So the union, it was a strong... Millers Point, no doubt, was a stronghold for the maritime unions, no question about it. And some of the most, strident supporters of those principles and those organisations, particularly the Waterside Workers' Federation, lived and came from Millers Point. And, I'm not an expert on the history of that, but I just simply know it's the case. The same with the other maritime unions, including the Seamen's Union, where many of the stalwarts of that union lived or based themselves at Millers Point. And they came from all over the world. They weren't just locals. They didn't grow up at Millers Point. They grew up in other parts of the world. Might be English or whatever, but, well-known Millers Point characters. And also even including the Communist Party, where I know one or two officials of the Communist Party were residents of Millers Point as well. So there's always been that, as far as I know, Frank, always been that strong association with the maritime unions and Millers Point, always.
Well, I just have to take a break. It's the end of a tape. It's the end of tape number MPFH 12, side B.